My name is Liam Wickham, and I am the founder of game-production.com, where we seek to enable games industry professionals to plan better, lead better, and stop the crunch culture through building a community of support, knowledge, and training. Today, I'm delighted to introduce you to Anthony Kine, a lead producer at Mediatonic Games. They've made games such as Gears Pop, Murder by Numbers, and the upcoming Fall Guys Ultimate Knockout, which looks awesome. Anthony has worked on titles such as Madden, Championship Manager, and The Sims. Unlike nearly every producer that I've met or stalked on LinkedIn before now, Anthony has worked in games as both a lead designer and senior programmer. This gives him a unique understanding of making games, which I'm looking forward to delving into. He was lead designer on Championship Manager game back in 2009, which saw the franchise finally rise to become a viable alternative to Football Manager. Good evening, Anthony.
Good evening. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. How about you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks. Very good.
So you've had a busy day, I presume.
Very busy. Yeah. My publisher at the moment's out in the US, so I'm getting up in the morning, sorting out everything that's coming overnight, and then as soon as the afternoon hits, they all want to have meetings with me for the afternoon. So yeah, always busy. I have a morning of doing a load of work, and then straight into meetings after the afternoon.
But I take it because you love it, you wouldn't have it any other way.
Oh no, not at all. Yeah, I love a meeting. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that.
yeah, I imagine so. I like to do a little icebreaker at the beginning. So I've given a brief summary of somebody else's life, but how would you give us the real potted history and can you tell us what you're up to currently?
What can I say? I went to school. I wasn't particularly very good at school, but found a love of computers. Luckily, I think due to the fact my grandfather was a bit of a geeky man himself and was one of the first people I knew that had a home computer, which was an Acorn Electron, and persuaded my parents to buy me a BBC Micro, which was a really, really good computer, but horrible for somebody like myself who just wanted to play games. Yeah, sort of fell in love with that. And I had reasonable skill at maths and was terrible at everything else. So I sort of got into computer programming from about the age of like 9. I was doing it with my grandfather. And then with one of the guys at school, he was a really bright guy, went on to become a lawyer. And even at 9 years old, he was clever. Me and him used to spend break times with the school computer learning to do stuff. And then I went off to secondary school and I got a Commodore Amiga, which was more of a game machine. But by that time, I'd sort of lost the love of real gaming. It was more about the programming that I loved. So I got a thing called Amos, which was like a Unity of its day, really, where you could make games in it with BASIC. So I did that. I made a great little game called The Adventures of Grant Gibbon Morris, a guy I went to school with. It was probably the first case of cyberbullying in 1991 or whatever it was.
When I did Congratulations. It. I'll look that up to see if that's... Yeah. You should be looking at Wikipedia.
It was a three-level game where all the teachers were in the trees and you were Grant. A friend of mine called Sam did the graphics and you threw bananas up at the trees and knocked the teachers out. And then the final end of game boss was the headmaster. And then I sold the discs on the playground for £2 or £3, I think. So, did that.
And then you retired rich.
Yeah, there you go. And, and then sort of went through school thinking, okay, I quite like this computer programming. I'm not particularly good at anything else. Never really considered getting into games. I kept plugging away at making my own little ones at home because I really, really like football. Turned out I wasn't very good at it compared to most people. I knew I was never going to play for Manchester United, so I created a world where I could. That's what I wanted to do. Finished school and was sort of hanging around like Anko, which was a big company at the time with a game called Kickoff. We were in Dartford and I managed to sort of get my foot in the door sort of growing up around here. As a QA and stroke sort of junior programmer, really, and then just... Mm. Worked my way up the ladder in there, and I wish we would still be there if it wasn't for the fact that the owner of the company died and left me and Steve Screech, who was the guy that made Kickoff originally, the company. So me and him went off and sort of went on and did Championship Manager together, and then we went our separate ways after that after about 14 years of working together.
Since then, how come you've ended up where you are now?
I sort of jumped around a bit. So after Championship Manager, I thought, right, I don't really want to do any sports games for a while. I'm a little bit in a niche. So I went off and did some children's games for a little bit, P2. And that's when I really got into production. I thought, okay, that's a decent path. I reckon I can do this. So I had a quick go of that and got Peppa Pig out, which was a really successful title on the Nintendo DS. Got a Horrid Henry game out, which is one of the best things
I've ever heard. Yeah, yeah.
So I did them games. And then HB over in Canada came up and said, oh, we want you to come over and we need someone with experience with cricket and rugby that would know how to make them kind of games. So I went over there and made a baseball game, two American football games, and a golf game. Never got anywhere near a rugby game before. Yeah.
Ironic.
Yeah, I think I've been employed three times to make a cricket game and I've never finished one.
But okay, but so we're skipping around places you've worked, but I'm really interested in the experience that I know you've got, but you should tell our beautiful listeners about, because you're, like I was saying at the beginning, you're quite unique to me in that you've been a senior programmer, you've been a lead designer and led other designers, designed entire games, and I'm really interested in how you managed to get through all of these different jobs and different areas of expertise and skill base and end up as a producer and not as one of those.
Yeah. So I would actually mostly class myself as a computer programmer more so than anything else. But much like I am a guitar player, I only never learned to play guitar because I wanted to play a song in a pub. I only learned to computer program because I wanted to make a game. And when I started at Anko was a very strange setup compared to modern studios. It was the boss, a group of programmers, a set of artists and some QA, and everyone just coded and did the art for the code. There was no producers, there was no designers. And Steve Screecher was the sort of creative director there and programmer, was running most things game direction-wise. And I think I'm quite vocal and I was massively excited to be in games. I've always thought that if you're going to make games, don't just sit there and just do what you're told. Like, you make the game. So I think pretty much even as a teenager working there, I was given input on how we should do it. And it sort of just naturally, I sort of rose to the top. To me and Steve, used to sit together and basically bounce ideas off each other. There was no documentation. There was no producers. And there was no perfils. And so what happened at the end of each day was that everyone would give me the code and I'd merge by hand. So at 5:30, everyone would give me the code. I'd stay at work till 6:30, merging everyone's code. And I'd put the code base back on the server and everyone would download it again in the morning.
I don't understand why they don't do things like that these days.
Yeah, I know. Well, it was great because no one could fire me because apparently I was the only one to do it. But it wasn't even that hard. Like, but what it did is it gave me a sort of background in making sure that I knew what everyone was doing. So sort of that production style, like how the project is built and what everyone was doing and sort of making sure everyone had enough work and stuff like that. And I had to do that to make my life easier to merge the code at the end of the day. So that was sort of my first steps. But then when I sold Floodlit, which we renamed Anko after taking it over to Eidos, Eidos said to us, do you want to be a programmer? Do you want to be a designer? Do you want to be a producer? So I was like, I don't know what a producer does. I had no idea. I'd never seen one before. And I knew I didn't want to be a programmer that programmed what I was going to be told to do. So I went, oh, okay, I'll be a designer. It was a disaster, really, because I was really good at maths and really bad at English. So I had to write all these documents. So I learned on the job, really, and worked my way up there. And I was there for 7 years in the end. I was a lead designer by the time I left.
What did design documents look like then?
They look like huge, huge, like
IBM manuals.
They're like bought like huge. Like, I remember the 50-page documents, and they were like written, and nobody was ever reading them. And it was like, God. And I remember I used to complain all the time. This is not the way it should be done. It shouldn't be done like that. And everyone was looking at me like I was insane. Like, what are you talking about? You just complain. This is why it's always done. And I was going, but surely this is not making games. This is just boring. It felt like a sort of working at a full production plant where it's just everything was going down one by one by one. And then a few of the production team went off to GDC and came back and they said, oh, we're going to do agile and all of this. And I was going, what's this now we've got to do? And I was like, ah. And they came back with Agile, and I was like, well, this is what I was sort of telling you to do before, but apparently because I said it, I didn't have a name for it. It wasn't called.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then we started doing that, and I could see the benefits of that. And then, as I said, I saw lots of producers come and go there, and I was like, I think I can do this better. And then when the option came up to go and do the small children's games as a producer, I thought, all right, I'll have a go at this and then see how good or bad I actually am and see if I've got the ability, that the belief I think I have. And I remember when I did become a producer, I got quite a lot of messages from ex-producers saying, you hate producers, why have you become one?
Were you right? Were you a good producer? Are you a good producer? Were you better than them?
I believe so. Talking to people that I've worked with in the last 10 years as a producer, they always think I'm good, unless they're just telling me that to my face. But yeah, like I think I allow people to do their jobs, and then they feel that they're actually making a game. And I think that's the one thing that I think a lot of people sort of get distracted from when they are producing.
Just looking at your LinkedIn profile, you express some opinions in there about your experience being useful, and you're saying that it has a huge advantage as you understand where people from different areas are coming from.
Yeah. So I think like what you find in production is that a lot of people come straight out of QA, and it's like a natural path in the games industry where you go in at QA and you work really hard, you do really well, and then you become a producer. And then if you do really well, you become head studio. It sort of goes in that sort of linear path. And what happens is a lot of people that are in production that come from QA would prefer to still be in QA. The problem is that the industry doesn't allow itself to make you flourish in that department, which is really disappointing. You should be able to. I know a guy that was extremely good QA, one of the best QAs I've ever seen. Like, he used to get in people's heads, he used to go and talk to programmers just to get in their heads so he knew how they'd screw something up, and he'd go, I know how this guy's going to do it, and he'd break it. And it was superb. And the only way out of that was for him to go up into production and or design, and we got there, and he was no good at it. So he kept getting fired after that, and he doesn't want to go back to QA. So it's like, damn. Where what I've found is coming from certain, like a different sort of route up, is that I can call bullshit a little bit on programmers, which is great, because as a programmer, as I said, I'm actually class myself as a programmer more than anything else, is we're a lazy bunch of people. There's a reason we're computer programmers, is like, if you write a piece of code that like does something, you then put a loop around it so it can do it a million times rather than you have to do it by hand a million times. It's like, that's why you get into computer programming. And you know, we'll always have an explanation of why something can't be done.
Yeah.
So to be able to go, well, it can be done, and what about this, and come up with like different ways of doing it, having a conversation with a programmer that they don't have to simplify everything down to the most basic thing gives them, I think, a little bit more respect for you. Yeah, and coming from a design background as well, you can always look at the troubles that people are going to have along the way that you can point out and see down the line. Saying that, I have a huge problem because I'm useless at art, and I can't draw, and it's the one thing I actually could never do in games is draw any art or anything. That I don't see them problems in art, and then that's why I always need a good artistic producer or a good art lead wherever I am, because that really improves the project.
Okay, so let's look at those things. You mentioned about coders. My experience of coders is that they are born problem solvers. They would love a problem that they can be given the rest of their lives to go and solve. Is a lot of coders are like that. And I guess you'd be able to call bullshit on that sort of thing as well, right? You know how long a thing should take as well, I imagine.
Yeah. And like, I think the other thing about coders is that they'll always look for the most fun technical way of solving something. So you go, okay, we need to do this and this. And they'll go, okay, well, it needs to be written in a completely new language that we've never looked at before, but it means we can do that. And you go, or you could just put an if statement around it. And but that's a bit hacky. It's like, no one cares. Like, nobody knows. And like, they always want to make the perfect piece of code and the perfect world, where as a programmer, as a programmer who's a game designer, I concentrate on what the game does more than what the code does. And yeah, there's a certain architecture to the code that has to be right, so you're not troubled with it for the rest of your time working on that product. But you need to be like focused on what the output to the user is and not what the code look like. And that's what a lot of programmers unfortunately get bogged down in.
So if we look at your design skills as well, your experience there as a lead designer on Championship Manager and others, Championship Manager and onwards, you have held creative vision, haven't you? You've wanted that vision. You've wanted to direct that vision if you're a senior or exec producer.
Yeah, I would say from before that as well, most probably from the player manager days back at Anko, I was most probably holding the creative vision for that as well, joint with Steve Screech. So kickoff 2002, player manager 98 onwards, most probably I was most probably holding that creative vision.
And you made it pretty clear that you quite like being, you sort of climbed up to the top because you wanted to be able to make those decisions and you wanted to influence, and you think that to be in the games industry, that you have a certain passion that you can contribute. Do you think that that's a natural trait for any producer?
I think it should be a natural trait for anyone in the industry, because I don't understand why you would work in it if you could earn more money being told what to do in banking or something else. It's like, we all want to make games. It's like, we should all be willing to have an opinion on what we're making. Like, if I'm a programmer and I want to see cool code, I can do that at Bloomberg. Right? So get paid 3 times the money. So like, I want to be able to make the game and go, okay, I coded that. This is really cool. And I had this influence on the game. I think that's how I think people think.
So if you want your name and title on the credits, you want to make sure that you've contributed to all areas. And I'm wondering though, I mean, I've worked in places where there are very strong design and art directors on a single game, and they would not take kindly to a producer coming in and saying, right, well, I'm the EP, I should be holding the creative vision here. They would expect that to come from them or a creative director, not a producer. How would you deal with that? And what's your opinion about that?
It is a thing that you come up against, but there's two, three, several things from that. Is that the person is the who owns the creative vision for that title should be the best person to hold the creative vision for that title. I wouldn't like, there's a big thing around in the last 10 years that everyone's fighting to be creative. I know when I was doing, I was a VR director at Imagination, there was like all this stuff about, I'm a creative. It's like, what does that mean? Like I'm really creative in making sports games, primarily because I really love sport and I can see stuff. I understand games. I understand sport. And it's like a really good melting pot for me to give my opinion.
Sure.
My dad is a carpenter. He's really creative at building sheds, like that I'm not. Yeah. And, you know, X, Y, and Z. So everyone should have a creative opinion. The problem I've always had with designers is design isn't primarily a creative job. It's an architectural job. It's a mechanics-based job. And this is the way I try and always run my teams, is that you run in pods of 5 or 6, 7, depending on the size of the feature. And the designer is the person who has the most background and knowledge about how mechanically it should work and the thought about how the knock-ons will affect the user. But that doesn't mean that the QA person cannot run with an idea, or the programmer cannot run with the idea, or an artist can run with the idea. You shouldn't be compartmentalized into you're not an ideas person and I am an ideas person. And I think a lot of people get into game design because they fancy themselves as blue sky thinkers when it's a mechanical job. That's, I think, one of the big surprises for me when I got into design as well. It was like, oh, well, I don't just sit there and come up with ideas. I have to mechanically think about everything. And it's a hard job. It's an extremely hard job. It was like way harder than programming, because you're thinking like a programmer but don't have the output to bug test against. And then everyone hates you. Everyone thinks they can do your job better than you. The cleaner comes in, she thinks she can do the job better than you. It's like, everyone can do this job better than me. And it's like UI as well. I think design and UI are mostly two jobs which get as much criticism off the exec or anything, because everyone thinks they can do it better than you. Coming from a programming background and my team that I had at Eidos, I remember they used to mention this quite a lot, is that I was always the person standing there going, well, this is what we want. They'd all come up with a lot of cool ideas. And then we'd try and design it out. And you go, actually, we don't need all this. You can actually get away with it if we just do X, Y, and Z, and it's a smoke and mirrors and no one would ever see. And you'll go, boom, 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 and it'll work that. Oh, yeah, cool, we can do that. And then where, as I said, if you've got programmers who are always looking for the coolest tech and you've got designers who are always thinking out here, it's like, this can never be done. This can never, and then all these arguments start. And there's always a simple route. And that's what I've found. That's always good in production as well, is I'm great at watching an argument between programmers and designers. And I like to see them flourish for at least 10 minutes until I step in and go, well, let's have a listen. Okay, we can mostly simplify this by doing that and get into a result quicker.
So I suppose I see you holding quite a kaleidoscope of roles when you describe yourself as a producer. If I compare that to a lot of other producers, right, who don't have that luxury of that background, if you will. When you look at other producers, with these producers working for you or producers that you've seen elsewhere, what would you say is like the absolute bare minimum experience and skill set that a producer needs to have these days?
I think bare minimum, the one thing I look for most is personability. Because if you can't deal with the people, there's no way out. And then it's keeping calm and like going, okay, how do we do that? Because as soon as you start panicking, everyone else around you starts panicking. Mm-hmm. And there's no, you know, we make games for a living, no one's gonna die. Like, so it's like calm down, like relax, and like you've got, you know, be personable and relax, basically.
Yeah. Okay. So those are, I mean, anyone can have that as a character trait or personality trait. But in terms of technical expertise, in terms of training, in terms of foundation knowledge, do you look around and despair a little bit and go, I wish people had more of X, Y, and Z?
One of the things I look for massively when interviewing people is a creativity within their approach. So as we were saying earlier about creativity is like my dad's got the creativity of building a shed. And the same way, it's like a producer should not just be happy that he went on a course and he learned Agile and this is this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And what I always try and get out of people in an interview is, you know, if this happened, what would you do? And they're always going to try and hit them notes that they think you want to hear about Agile or Waterfall or whatever. But I want to see like a way of their thinking to make them think, how can I do this better? Because no process is ever perfect. So you always should go into a place and go, how can I get this better? How can I improve this? How can I reduce the amount of meetings? How can I, like, and Agile's got a huge amount of problems. You know, it's got loads and loads of things that will slow you down if you're not doing it right. So it's always like, how do I go into a place and improve that sort of thing? So that's what I look for when I'm interviewing people. And I think that's, you know, if you're just a by the book producer, you're normally going to hit your ceiling pretty quickly.
That sounds like that would be a definition of a project manager rather than a producer, right?
Yeah,
by the numbers,
yeah. And that's the thing is I've worked in places where I am the producer, like when you're working on Madden and even the golf club. Like I was the producer is the person that really holds that creative vision and makes sure the right decisions are being made. As well as having a project manager, I always be in charge of exactly how much of that project management I think we were doing, which mm-hmm. is being lucky.
That's very interesting too. There's a strong dream in this conversation of the producer as a leader, the producer as a senior member of the team. And I suppose I'd be really interested, and maybe you're not in a position to tell me, but I can ask someone else. But what's it like working for you as a producer? What are you giving the producers underneath you? What how do you sort of mentor them and train them?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. One, it's fun because I've never in my 23 years of working in the games industry woken up and not wanting to go to work. So I definitely don't want to make that situation for anyone else. So try and have as much fun as possible. But I'm also the person that will stick up for them, make sure nothing silly comes in, and always be there to help them out without being a micromanager. as a person, I'm might bring up my father again, but like he's a really good carpenter. I'm rubbish at carpentry because he can't keep his hands out of it. And the reason I got into computers is because he didn't have a clue about them, so I could actually sit there and learn. And I'm a big believer in letting people run away, like learn stuff, try and do it yourself, and then when you hit some problems, come and see me and I'll help you out. And like I'll let people go for a few days without having to stick my nose in what they're doing if they're not asking. But yeah, I'm a hands-off producer really in all disciplines.
But as a but in the long-term growth of a producer who's just started with you, let's say a junior producer, I mean, I know you're pretty senior now, so you probably don't deal directly with junior producers in terms of mentoring and training, but if they approached you and they said to you, you know, what's the three biggest bits of advice you could give me for becoming a successful producer in the future? You're going to maybe talk about personality, et cetera, and creativity, but what sort of hands down practical, you know, go off and grind over there, learn about this thing here. What sort of advice would you give them?
Seeing as I trained myself, it's a hard question to answer, really. What can I go and tell?
Sorry, mate, I'm just to reassure you, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. And I think everyone, you know, is going to give a different answer here, right? Because there's no foundation, is there? There's no set way of doing it.
No, and that's the thing. I think from my perspective, what I try and I like to do is get my ducks in a row so I sort of know exactly what's going on at all times without being too in-depth. I don't try and overload myself. I try and keep my life simple. I simplify everything. And that's what I always encourage people to do, is simplify everything down so it's very edible chunks in front of you, so you're not like overwhelmed. And get that down. Make sure you've got a strong personality so you can go into certain meetings and you're not bullied out of certain situations, which can rub people up the wrong way. But if you're personal about it, it normally goes okay. Mm-hmm. And sort of just get yourself always like friendly with the lead programmers and the lead artists and stuff. So them guys will really help you out when you need sort of backing in certain situations, and designers as well, obviously. But all your leads, make sure that them guys you're on the same level with, and you're going, okay, what are we going to do here? Get the sort of mission over to them of what you're trying to do, and make sure that they can help you out and sort of push in the same direction. Mm-hmm. But like from a skill set point of view, it's just, I think, be a strong personality, fully understand what's going on. And like, because tools wise, that's one of the great things about production is that I can run a whole project on a bit of paper, really. I don't need Jira. I don't need anything else. I use them. But skill wise is like, I think it's definitely worth going on all the courses for Agile, Waterfall, everything you can possibly go on, but don't take them as gospel. It always makes me laugh whenever you see a set of junior producers go off to an Agile course and next minute
they're all coming back
with their sticky notes all over the windows and stuff.
They've got religious clothing on.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, all them things were good, but it doesn't mean it's right 100%. It means take certain things that you think will work in this team, and every team that you work with will be different, and every game you work with will be different, because every publisher is different, and every group of people you work with is different.
So let's ask you a little bit about what you just said then about Agile, because so I was talking to Callum Godfrey a few days back for a podcast, and he's got a lot of mobile gaming experience, and he had a lot to say about Agile product management. And of course, in mobile gaming, there's a lot of there's a heavy emphasis on Agile software development type work and product methodology, etc. Whereas in PC console, it's more freeform, really, isn't it? It's like a more unwieldy beast, and for different reasons. And I'm wondering, why do you think it is that you can't, for example, turn up to your next AAA, a couple of hundred people, and say, right, we're all going to be doing Agile Scrum, let's go. Why doesn't that work? How would you explain that to somebody new?
Well, it doesn't work because of the certain set dates and like them dates and green light meetings are in sort of concrete and you can't move them. And the thing with the mobile development is that you've got very quick turnarounds with releases, especially like a lot of free to players. Like you need to be getting new content out every 2 to 4 weeks. So you need that sort of running system, where what you have with console, and like, and don't get me wrong, when you're starting out on a mobile game, I don't think it should be overly agile either. Because what happens is you start to lose the confidence of the exec teams that you're dealing with if you're like too agile and you go, oh, we just don't worry, it's just gone over another sprint and all this. Where in console, I think I sort of run a normal on a console stuff, a semi-agile system where we have a milestone. We might have a couple of sprints within that milestone. It could be a 3-month milestone. And I'm not a hard believer in 2-week sprints. That's another thing that winds me up is people that read it in a book once, so they think that's what it should be. It's like a sprint is something, and this is why I really loved Agile when I first came across it, was that a sprint is something that gives you a period of time to complete something and sort of like a contract between the team and the publisher or the team and the producer. Say, in X amount of time, we will get this to you. And within that team, everyone has buy-in and can be creative to getting that to you in a way that's really cool and playable. And so you can do it in console like that, but you've always got to remember that you've got a deadline that you've got to hit in every X amount of months to free up the next chunk of money. And and that's sort of why you can't slip and you can't go, oh, well, it didn't quite meet the thing. Like to move a story or an epic into complete, it needs to be everything's perfect. Otherwise it doesn't go and it goes into the next sprint. At certain points in console development, you've got to go, it's good enough now. Like, boom, get to that. And I don't think you can really do that with mobile, especially free to play. You've got to be so spot on 100% in the little tweaks that you make. Otherwise, it could have massive dents on your KPIs.
When you're first starting a new game and you're at the point of discovery and working out what it should be and you're putting a little team together, etc., would you use agile tactics then?
Yeah, so what I try and always do in that situation is, like, normally somebody will come to me, take the golf club for an example. We got told, okay, we're going to want to be the first golf game on PS4. We know EA aren't making one. And I went, okay, cool. Always wanted to make a golf game. Sweet. So we got a team together and we'd already been working on a little tank demo to see what the Unity engine could do and stuff. So we went, okay, we'll use that for terrain generation. And I set a little tech team and I said, okay, I've got 4 weeks to a green light meeting. Let's see what we can do with this terrain.
Tanks
generation.
And golf clubs.
Yeah.
I'm in.
And see what we can do just to generate some golf courses, because we weren't going to have any golf courses in the game because we had no license money or anything like that. So it was cool. So they went off and it gave them a little fun 4 weeks to go away and play around with stuff and enjoy stuff. You know, we were saying about programmers earlier. They love that sort of tech things, like turn this tank sim into a golf game and let it be fun. And in that time, then I went away and created a document with the design team of what the game should be, sort of areas of the game, like 7 or 8 features, what them features were, what they weren't, what the visual guide should be, what it wasn't going to be. So there's not going to be no fire coming at the balls. It was going to be ultra realistic, like X, Y, and Z. And then we go back to the exec with a PowerPoint that says what the game is and what the game isn't, and a little cool tech demo that showed we can create golf courses with 3 clicks of a button in 4 weeks. This has got nice. Really good potential.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, nice. Okay, what can we do next? I said, well, next, give us 4 weeks again and we'll have the game playing. So we had a baseball player from the baseball game I'd made before, and the baseball player was hitting a golf ball around on one of the generated courses. But so I set it up into 4-week sort of chunks of things that people thought was actually achievable. Because and what happens a lot of time with 2-week sprints is that people can't see anything achievable, especially when you have sprint plan and retrospectives and all that. You go, well, it's only actually 8 days of development if you're lucky. So you might as well get pushed to a 4-week sprint in the early stages of development. And then when you get further and further down the line, especially when you're doing updates and stuff, you go to a cadence of 2 weeks. It always seems more sensible.
So how do you, as the guy in charge of that, come to a decision during that month of when features aren't going well, when they are, et cetera, and when to cut them? And how do you make those sort of decisions? How would you advise others who are producers to make those sort of decisions?
I'm playing the game constantly. It's one of the other questions that I always ask people when I'm interviewing them is like, what will you do when everything's running perfectly? Because so many producers say, oh, I'll have a meeting. It's like, well, don't have a meeting. Everything's running perfectly. Like, play the game.
Do you know what? I have to interrupt you there. I cannot believe the number of people on game teams generally, not just producers, who'd never play the game or who don't really like it.
Yeah.
But just never play it ever. And you go, well, you know that bit there? And they go, no, sorry, I haven't played it. What? Yeah. You're a year in. Yeah.
And that's what blows my mind. And it's like, that's what I try and make sure that people do when they're on my teams, is that they do play the game. They do enjoy what they're doing and they can see what we're doing. And like, especially on the golf club, what we did once we got to a certain stage of development, we're still very early when we saw a baseball player hitting like sideways and the ball was shooting off from the ground. But we had a Friday round of golf. Everyone in the team was playing. And then we had leaderboards and everyone had to get their code checked in by 11 o'clock on Friday morning. And then Friday afternoon, we'd sit down and we'd play the game. And this shame, I'm a big believer in shame, and I'm mostly like, not doing myself any favors by saying that if I put it in a book, but like it's the show. Like if you're putting your work in and it's the worst bit of work for the week, it's like, oh my God, I can't let that happen again next week. Like, and one of my best mates, like he was the physics programmer on the golf game, and he'd done something completely wrong that week, and he got so much grief for the whole round from everyone shouting across the studio that it wasn't working. He goes, I know. And then the next week he was there Thursday night. And I remember driving past the studio to go to the grocery store. I went, why is his car still there? So I went in and he goes, I've just got to fix this because I can't have the shame of last week.
See, it works. But these days you call shame intrinsic motivation. So you've got a nice American phrase for it. So, but I think that's true as well. Okay. I remember we did the same thing at PlayStation Home. We do the same thing on a Friday and have demos in the morning and people playing it on the afternoon. And it made a huge difference when we instigated that, when we were willing to make that sacrifice. And, you know, I've worked places before where we haven't had, for example, a weekly presentation demo of the game to the whole team. And then it gets introduced and everybody starts going, oh, wow, okay, that's what we're making. And it does make a huge difference, doesn't it? It comes back to the very beginning of this chat. You don't want making a game to be a mechanical thing where people are just going through the conveyor belt of, I have made another art asset and checked it in. You want it to be more than that for everybody in your team, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Like I always look, I basically break everything down into either music or football as an analogy. So right. Like,
and say Bruce.
Yeah. So Bruce Springsteen, like when he's writing, making Born to Run, he's not got a load of musicians in there and said, right, play this note and then play this note and then play this note and then play this note. It's like, okay, this is my song, let's go, smash it. And then they go and they just like jam until they've got good solos and stuff, and they work it and they feel the music when they're playing it, and that's how you get what you want. That's sort of the way I look at making games, because if you've got to feel what you're making, if you can't, the user, when they pick it up, can feel it's a made-by-numbers type of game.
Yeah, a clone.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what a lot of game studios fall into. It doesn't matter how much money you pile into a product. If you haven't got the buy-in from the team and the team aren't playing it, then it feels like a paint-by-numbers kind of game.
You were saying a little while ago that producers might turn around to you, or producers in the past turn around to you and said, why are you producing? You hate producers. Now, back then, what did you hate? What was it that producers, you had to name anybody, but although I'd love it if you did, but what did you particularly hate back then? What was it, and or now, what was it that really wound you up, that made you think production just isn't being done right?
My thing that really wound me up, and I made the point, and I actually got a warning for it, was that one of the production team was criticizing one of the QA guys. And I made the point that you could lock me and that QA guy in a room for half a day and we'd come out with a game, where I could lock you guys up in there for 10 months and you still wouldn't have any. And it's like, it was just a bunch of guys that sort of felt they ran things that couldn't really make anything. And I also felt that, especially at Eidos, the production team had a belief that programmers were like magic wizards that made the box talk. And so they, whatever the programmer said was gospel. And it was like, what are you doing? This is not true. And like, they're going, oh no, like, we don't need designers. We don't need this. We're production. We can do it. And it's like, man, so many bad decisions were made. It wasn't until we got a new studio manager and I got promoted onto the top table that we actually made a 9 out of 10 game, which was Championship Manager 10. So that was the 9 out of 10 game, you know, and we had a really good, strong quality team that we were painting by numbers at that point and up until that point. And then we went, okay, we can do this better. And we still had we were carrying a lot of people that we shouldn't have been carrying. But
what were the producers doing wrong during that time?
I think, well, one, that they had no, they didn't have a concept of making the game, I don't think, and how to go about it in the way that I would have done anyway. And I don't know, if I look back on it now, I'd most probably go, oh God, they're most probably right, because of the experience. But coming from a point where I was making a game from scratch as a programmer with a group of about 10 people, and then over a period of 6 years with 100 times the budget, these people weren't making games as good. It was just blowing my mind. And there was a lot of meetings that were just pointless. It was like, I remember sitting in a meeting and the first 20 minutes of one meeting was constantly about what people did at the weekend. It's like, I don't care what you did at the weekend. I'm trying to make this game. It was just general chit-chat. And it was like, a meeting room has been booked for an hour and a half, so we're going to definitely make sure we're in it for an hour and a half.
Right.
No real decisions were ever being made. And that's, I think, and that's the other thing I think was a huge, huge thing with very, like, very few producers are very good at, is that you should be the person that makes the decision and is not scared of making a decision. And there's an extreme amount of talent in being able to get a game out the door that people, there's no way of really just like sort of seeing it on a CV or anything, but it's like getting a game out the door. A lot of people get to the point where when they're a game director or whatever, the person with the buck stops at, they get scared and they go, well, we can't release yet. We'll just do a little bit more, just do a little bit more, just do a little bit more. And I've seen so many people do it and money gets thrown away. It's like, just release it. Like,
day one patch, mate.
Yeah, exactly. That's my favorite.
So again, we're back to this common point that you're making, which is really interesting. And I hadn't really thought about it exclusively before, but you're saying that at all levels of production, from a junior producer upwards, there's going to become a point where you have to lead, you have to make a decision. Even the most junior producer, right, who's put in charge of a smaller team, there's a point at which they have to say, well, no, you're not going to do that. Or yes, we need to do this. And I think that's probably why that the producers who survived that experience go on to become senior members of a game studio.
You need to be the person that's not scared to make a decision. And I think you most probably survive by making more right decisions than wrong decisions. And and that's why a lot of people don't make the decisions, and they survive with a nice, tasty career for most of their life because they've never made a wrong decision. And you're going, well, yeah, if you've not made any decisions, then it's like, but I'm always going to be the one that makes it, like, is going to have an opinion and make a decision. I could be wrong. I'm lucky that I haven't made huge ones in the past. I'm normally like pretty good at feeling what the game's about. And I think that's what I say about like holding a creative vision and stuff in the past, is that if I do hold the creative vision and the plan and I can make the decision, I can make the right decision. It's when if you've got a project manager and you've got a creative director and they're both going, well, one person's got to try and get it out on this date and the other person doesn't care unless it's got X feature, there's two people pulling in different directions and it never really works. So it always has to be one person that the decision lies with. And that's why you've got your game directors or whatever they're called now, product directors and people like that, because they've got to be that person that makes them decisions.
It seems to me a lot of the roles that have been created in the fledgling gaming industry have been created to address the tensions that you're describing. They're basically, they can see something being pulled in a direction, so they just create a role to try and balance it out. It's like creating pieces on a chessboard that weren't there before. And it seems to be becoming more and more complex, not necessarily for the right reasons.
Yeah. And I think the more cooks you put in the kitchen, the more complex it's always going to be. And that's the thing. It's like for every person who has a deciding vote, the more watered down your product becomes. Because it, you know, you trying to give people their easy win, and this was one thing I had to learn over a period of time, was that, you know, I had to bite my tongue sometimes. But I always hated that. So I'll just give them the easy win there, and then you'll win the next one. It's like, we're making a game. We should all be making the right decision all the time. I struggled with that, and I still do. I'm very lucky that I've worked at particularly good places, really, I think, over the, especially the, as a producer. You know, HB, Mediatonic, they're really nice companies to work for, that let you, like, don't feel that you have to get your easy win out of the way, or you, you know, you've been given a win to do something. Everyone's pushing in the same direction, so it's,
yeah,
like, handy in that respect. But yeah, it's like, I just, yeah, the more people you have, the more it waters it down, in my opinion. I think if you've got one man's vision, one woman's vision, that person should be the person. They don't have to own everything, but everyone should be creative within the pillars of what's being set out, but the final decision needs to be made by somebody.
Yeah, okay. And I think if you look at any kind of leadership training or modern leadership training, the death by committee thing is pretty much always is always spoken about as something you want to try and avoid. That strong leadership is something where you're kind of extolling the virtues of everybody on your team, but you're also the person they know they can trust, that when the shit hits the fan, you go, I'm making a decision. And not only that, I will back the fact that it was me who made this decision. I'm not going to stab you in the back with it. I imagine your style would lead, if it's consistent, to people trusting you quite a lot.
Definitely. I think most of the people that I've ever worked with will always work with me again and would always recommend me for jobs because of that. Because I will always back them. I've never thrown anyone under the bus. You know, if I thought something wasn't going the right way and they were making bad decisions, I would make sure that I got there first to stop that from anyone else seeing it. Mm-hmm. And then if I make the decision that everyone else is not happy with, it doesn't happen very often, because normally after a discussion, we come to a conclusion. You know, I'm not the person who goes, oh, this is what it should be. It's like, I come to a decision and make the decision off of the back of a conversation with everyone. Then you go, I'll live with that. I've made that decision, and I'm going to be the person that lives or dies by it. Because that, I think, is one of the biggest parts of the job.
Do you think that's where producers are accountable to communicate properly, and especially at a senior level, to communicate to the team what's going on?
Definitely. Like, I know from my personal experience, say when I was the lead designer at Eidos there, and you're writing 50-page documents that you knew nobody was going to read. It's like you're sitting there and it's just like, I stayed there because I always wanted to make that game and I loved making it. But the day-to-day of the office was like half of what you were doing just felt like it was pointless. Mm-hmm. And it's like the reason I got into production was so I could stop pointlessness happening on development teams. You know, do I succeed? Most probably not. Like when you've got a team of 60, 70 people sometimes, and publishers are asking for stuff that you know is not going to happen, but it ticks a box to keep them happy for a little bit. It's like, okay, you got to do it. And sometimes, you know, the decisions are made, but I try and reduce it down. You know, I constantly look around the room and go, people are looking bored, or they're looking upset or agitated. It's like, okay, we've got to make sure that if that's the case, then they're doing something that they can really enjoy, because, you know, we say that people do it for a reason. They want to make games for a living.
I was going to say, pick one game that you've worked on and tell us what you were responsible for. And now you've picked the golf club. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the golf club, as I said, we knew that the Tiger Woods game wasn't coming out on the PS4, and the PS4 was just about to come out, and everyone buys a golf game. I remember the head studio said, let's make a golf game. So yeah, so then we went off and we decided we would try and make a game. Like, I remember picking up the Tiger Woods game, and I put it in the PlayStation. I don't think I got on the first tee for about 20 minutes because it was just so much going through with Fatui and update downloads and everything else. And it was like, this is horrendous. I don't even want to play it now. And then I played around and I got a hole in one on the 18th hole of the first round. And I went, this is nothing like the golf I've played. We knew we didn't have any licenses. originally we said, okay, we'll make it a three click through from the main menu or auto generate a course and you play it.
Yep.
We overachieved so quickly on the auto generating of golf courses that we started adding feature by feature to that. And we had a little pod of people working on that. And we just go, okay, now let's see if we can place bunkers. Let's see if we can do this. And by the end of it, at the end of the whole product, we had such a great course creator and then the ability to share cross-platform. So you could make one play at PS4 and it would come out on the Xbox or PC. That people were making Augusta, Pebble Beach and all these other famous golf courses that we didn't have the licenses for, but it didn't matter because people made them, we didn't. So we had all the licenses that were coming out. Plus my point for the game at the beginning was it should have been a game for the everyday golfer. It should represent what we were doing out on the course. So I'm like one of the worst golfers in the world ever, but I do enjoy going out there. I say I enjoy the idea of going out there, and then I get out there and start throwing my clubs around. So I said, like, we should be able to play the game with the thought processes that go through your head, but without the skill needed to make the ball not curve into the woods every time you hit it. So that was always the mantra of the game, and it would be good to play on home-style courses. And there would be one level for all. There's no difficulty levels, no options to turn certain things off and on. And the difficulty was by choosing the course. So if you choose a really hard course, that means you wanted a hard challenge, and if you chose an easy course. And that was the way it was. And then we got all these golf courses coming by the community. It blew up. EA released their game, and I think it had 8 courses. And by that time, we had 147,000. And they ran into the distance and never released a golf game again. And then, yeah, the golf club got picked up by 2K. So 2K are releasing it now. I had a vision for what it wanted to be. It was shared with the head of studio at the time, Jeremy, who was also a big golfer. And he wanted to make a hard golf game as well. So that was sort of shared. But what I did, I think the biggest thing that I added to that project was that a lot of people came on the project going, oh my God, this is going to be an absolute shit show. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? And I got everyone bought into it until we were the cool project in the studio and everyone wanted to be on it. And we were having fun. There was a lot of laughs. There was some overtime as well. But as a team, we just really bonded and everyone knew what they were making. And I got some really good people. I got people that were thought of as being average to become superstars as well because of the way that they were allowed to work, which was nice.
I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to look back on and recognize in any career, isn't it? Can you give me any examples of how you did that with anyone?
Well, I think it's just the fact that because it was our own project and it was self-published, I didn't need to please a publisher. I only had to please the head of studio who's funding it with his own money. He's of a similar like mind to myself. He's the guy that wrote Emily and Hugh's Soccer on the Commodore 64. So he's more old school than myself. And he just wanted to see the game monthly and it getting better and him to be able to give feedback on it. And like we built something for him that he could play around with after a month and he was stuck in his office. He didn't move from his office for like the whole time of development. They'd be building more stuff only to come out and tell me more bugs he'd found. But he loved it. You know, and without him, he had an amazing eye for art, which I don't have. And without him, our game would not have looked as good. Or without our lead artist, Jim O'Brien, who was amazing as well. So it was like as I was saying, because there wasn't any publisher or anything else, it meant that I could just get to the nitty-gritty of making the game and letting people be creative at making the game. So it was like, okay, here's a group of you. You're on the course creator. You're doing that. Let's say 3 weeks. Let's try and get X, Y, and Z in. See what we can do. Okay, do I need a tech document? No, don't worry about it. Just smash it in, like, and we'll see where we are. And if we don't like it, we'll scrap it. And just really quick, iterative, fail-fast development. So we got rid of design docs. You know, we had a Confluence page where the designer would sort of fill out what we sort of had discussed. And we go, okay, we want this feature to be that. We want this feature to be this. And then people just work together as a group. And it was my point to a lot of the other producers at the time. I go, that is Scrum development. When you see people sitting around in a huddle and
that's
working
a Scrum, literally.
Yeah. And it's not standing there in a room with 29 people going, yesterday I did this and today I did this. It's like, there's nothing more boring. Like, and if I find something boring, I think, you know, I'm touching on ADD, I think, most of the time, because if it, my attention cannot be held for more than 5 minutes. If I find it boring, then it's normally cancelled because everyone else must be finding it boring as well. That is Scrum development. I think that's, once people got into that and they could work as a team and they could feel, oh, I'm programming to do this, and I'm not just doing what this tech design document told me I had to do, they became superstars, because most people that said they're creative people and they weren't there to just try and please like their bosses and work through a document. And that's, I think one of the things, big problems with British education system, don't even get me started there, but it helps people work in a way that they work X, Y, and Z, and it doesn't give any hope to anybody outside of that. And if it wasn't for me getting my shoe in the door, I'd must be Amazon like shift worker now, like if I was lucky, you know. And I try and make sure that people with the same kind of skill sets as me get the chance to show off them skills.
I can see why people would trust you and want to work with you again with that sort of attitude. So how much of your job was project management? What form did this take?
I was the only project manager on them Golf Club Games. So I was a producer, project manager. We did have project managers, but I think I got rid of one to free up the budget so I could get another programmer.
Very common, I find, yeah.
Yeah. So, and as I said, because we didn't have the publisher syndrome, I didn't have to show off a load of burndown graphs constantly of how well we were doing. I just managed the team as simply as possible in Jira and just said, okay, these are what we're doing. We don't need, like, I don't believe in the healing power of graphs. I don't care where these things are going out. Like, this is just a brief set of epics of what we've got to do. This is the backlog of where we are. We'll put some estimates and story points against it, and we had a cut line, and we could constantly see, we go, okay, bang, 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 we're mostly going to get to here, and that's where it is. And then when other features would come in, we go, okay, are we going to do this? Is this more important than this? And then it was basically just me, the head of the studio, and the COO would sit down monthly and go, if we want these things, that means these things are going to drop, or we extend the time. And the team, the same way. It's like, okay, well, I'd like to see this extra feature in. Okay, we can fit that in. Is it more important than this? Yeah, okay, we lose that. And everyone had a good concept of, this is what we're going to release with, and do we want to give it extra time?
So that little triumvirate of people making those decisions, was that, did that work because of the closeness to the team and the communications? Because I can imagine in some game companies, in some game teams, there's no way a couple of people at the top really know what's going on, right?
Well, yeah, like if you go over to EA and stuff, the people at the very top. But then my belief is that should they really be making any decisions then? It's like that the only decision they should make is more budget, more time, or it's coming out, you know, and then they have to rely on the people that have got their hands dirty, really, on making a decision on if it's good enough to put their name to it. That's what was very good at HB, is that the COO was really cool guy, could see the game was good, really solid, but he wasn't getting himself involved in the creative in any way. He was just saying, this is the money we've got, we can continue doing it if we want to do it. And the head of studio owner was like, this game is really good, I'm really enjoying it, I'm playing it in my office all the time, keep going, and I want to add this feature and I want to add that.
Right. So two things there. Firstly, I take it, because he's a good guy, it wasn't a big problem when the owner wants to add a feature, but it can be, right?
Yeah, so that's that is an interesting one, because he always had opinions and not all of them are right, you know. It was always an interesting conversation. Like at the end of the day, my thought is always, it was his money. Yeah. And if he really believed in it, he's going to get his way. I would always go about it and tell him that I was looking out for him and his money and the game, and the team felt this and we all felt this, and should we do this and that? And he was a good guy. He listened and he said, yeah, okay. And, you know, 50-50, either go, okay, I'm listening to you, or half the time go, no, it's going my decision. And it's like, okay, it's your money, but that does mean you lose these things. Okay. And as long as you can make them things clear, I think that's the end, your job really at that point is to go, if you do this, it's going to cost you X, Y, and Z. And if you can always make that argument clear, then the decision's on them.
It's funny, isn't it? I think as a producer over the years, you become a bit of a philosopher around the concept of sacrifice and how everything costs something and it's only finite. As you approached the point of no return in terms of shipping it or in terms of just deciding to go live at some point, did tensions emerge then about how it should be another 6 months? No, we got to get out now or anything like that. How did you deal with that?
No, I don't think there was. There was a tension that we had to be out by a certain point. We'd gone a little bit long, and we did want to come out before anyone else announced that they were doing a golf game. So there was that, but we had our set of features, and then there was we dropped a couple of new extra things that we thought would be really good. Tension wise, no, there was like, I'm presuming, some heated discussions. As there normally is, but this is what it is, what happens. And then, yeah, we did some overtime. We did quite a bit of overtime. I think it was about 3-4 months. We knew what the cost of that was going to be, and everyone was happy with the cost of that. So
how I should have already asked you this really, but how big was the team?
Team was about, what was it at that point? It was around 30, I think.
Okay. So what's that, about 4 or 5 pods?
Yeah, it would be about that. So we had course creator, we had the gameplay team, we had the server guys, we had the what was the other teams there? Gameplays, physics. Yeah, so the physics team was all by itself as well. So yeah, it was about 4 or 5. UI.
I asked that because I'm just wondering, with 30 people, I guess it's easier for me to envisage that you really could do, the way you told me about planning and scheduling, etc., I can really see that. How that works. With far larger teams, I imagine, we know, right? There comes a point where planning's not that easy, where you have these kind of disciplines running into each other and methodologies running into each other and insourcing and outsourcing and all this sort of thing. How much experience have you got with the sort of the bigger teams and that kind of complex scheduling? And can you give an example to starting producers on what to expect when they hit that kind of next step up?
So you'll always, especially when you get to teams of 70 to 100 and stuff like that, it does get more complex. But as I said earlier, it's like I always try and simplify things down so it's always in edible bite-sized chunks for my brain to understand. So what I normally have is you have your pods set up and you have a sort of mini backlog for each of them set out and go, okay, these are the things we're going to do. And then you have sort of semi leaders within them. So it might be a producer, it might be a designer, it could be just a programmer. Anyone who I felt always had the most vocal aspect of that feature. And it was like, okay, we're going to do that. You run it for the next X amount of
a mini vision holder.
Yeah. And that would be the person that you go, okay, do that. You own it for the next X amount of time. Go off and run with that. Over the next set of months, we need to deliver this and this and this. And by these times, each week, I want to see whatever it is in the latest build. We play it. We all comment on it. But this is the date we've got to get it done by. And I think, like I said, it simplifies everything down. I'm never going to be the guy that gives out a task to everyone. I don't care if everyone's 100% flat out or 80% flat out. I don't care. I'd rather people be 40% flat out, 40% not flat out, and playing the game, as long as while they're waiting for someone else. I don't care if one guy's sitting there doing something or not doing something and he's going, well, I'm about to pull in some more tasks from something else to keep myself looking busy. It's like, play the game. Play the feature you're working on. Make sure it feels right. Feedback from it. And so that makes planning a lot easier because you're not micromanaging exactly what people are doing. You're just saying, as a group, make this for me in X amount of weeks.
How do you deal with dependencies?
As in, this feature is going to have a knock-on with this feature.
Yeah, so I guess in this case, the cross-pod dependencies, to invent a new term. So where one team's going to have an impact on another team or one team's waiting for another team, do you just deal with that in a nice, simplistic fashion? Or have you got a system you can share?
No, not really a system. It's normally what you'll do is I'll say to the guys, if there's something they're working on, say it's like an API or something, you just go set up a little black box of emptiness that has got the outputs of random numbers for the time being that you can plug into, and then when they finish their work, it will plug in and work. Or you just say, well, if it's not just not going to work, we go, okay, park back there for a little bit, go off and do this as a group, and then once this stuff's done, we'll come back round and circle around and get it.
Let's say you're relying on an art team to supply a bunch of different pods, and if that's how it works, would you rely upon a producer, to like a more junior producer than you, to look after that particular aspect?
It depends on previous experience with the producer. I'd always give them a few goes at it, and then see how well they do. But most of my pods always has an artist on it, always has a QA on it, always has a couple of programmers on it. So as a group, they're making it as a get, like, feel, so it should feel like a game jam team.
Yeah.
Really. So they're working as a group together to do something. So there should never be a dependency on a skill set. It should always be on a feature.
Mm. Okay, yeah. And that makes sense with Agile and the way you perform teams. And I like the use of the game jam. I was thinking about that earlier with some other things that you said. I think that approach naturally leads itself to empowering the creativity that you spoke up at the beginning, right, with people. Mm. So
a lot of people actually get a bit scared when I say that, because they go, oh, but game jams never work because the game always falls apart, like, really easily. And it's like, well, you don't use the quickness of a game jam. You use the, like, the mental sort of how you get into a game jam and go, as a group, we're making this, but you know, you've got 6 weeks to do something, so you're going to do it right. You're not just going to rush it out the door.
And I think maybe back to what we were saying earlier, or maybe I was, about personalities. I think there are a lot of people in the games industry who have picked it because, not just because you make games, but because they don't really want that kind of added responsibility. So I think you probably do terrify a few people.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm a believer in you've got to take a jump off the deep end sometimes, and, you know, and find out you can do it, you know, and I'm never going to let anyone struggle. If somebody looks like they're struggling, we'll make sure that they won't do that. But I want people to try and show me all the things that they in their head would love to do but haven't quite got the confidence, because that's when they'll get the confidence.
Yeah, that's where growth lies, isn't it?
Yeah.
So can you tell me about a time when the planning failed and you had to step in and sort things out? How did you do that?
When the planning failed? I think I'll go to another project for that, actually. I've done a couple of free-to-play games with the Major League Baseball guys over in the US. We massively underestimated how many people we would need to do it. They're a very demanding client, Major League Baseball, the gaming group. But a really good top bunch of guys. They're still good, great friends of mine. If the main guy over there ever in London, we normally meet up for a pint. But yeah, demanding of what they wanted. Their demands are on them because their bosses are putting a lot of pressure on them as well. And yeah, we signed two games with them, and we just didn't have enough to do the two games, really. And the plan I'd set out at the beginning was just like, no, this isn't going to work. It was our first ever title in Unity as well, so we were learning that.
Right, yeah.
So we made the Home Run Derby game, which is amazing, by the way, if you've got to download it, on the phone. Looks amazing. But we had a sort of semi-management game where you looked after one player's career and built him up through the thing, which I absolutely loved and played, but it looked horrendous. And, yeah, we sort of rushed out in the end just to meet a deadline. How did I fix it? I basically just begged and said, look, we're not going to get it done on time. We need more time. That was basically it. Yeah.
That is one of the massive problems, though, isn't it, of being given a lot of responsibility and kind of inheriting it by just being promoted to a position where you're in charge of a game, that you're given budgetary responsibilities. You're told to make things happen by a certain deadline. And almost inevitably, because it's life, money gets cut, time gets cut. Remarkably, you don't normally get more money or more time. I think there is a kind of a gray area where you just have to sit there and go, well, all right, we'll do our best, eh? See what happens. Do you think that's a natural part of making a big game? I think it's more about the big games or the high profile games.
It's a strange one. So I worked at a place called Asylum, absolutely shocking place. A guy called Simon Bailey ran it, refused to pay off his staff.
Hmm.
They made a Doctor Who game while I was working there for a few months, and they'd done it in like 6 or 7 months. And then he went off, and I think they'd go and sign another game and go, okay, that was we've done the last one in 6 months, like, and we can do this one in 6 months. Like, well, you done it in 12 months. It was just in 6 months actual time, but you done double the hours every day because everyone was working 16-hour days. What was really good when I went to HB, and they were based in Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia law means that if you work over a 40-hour week, for every hour you worked more, you got half an hour back until you got to 50 hours, I think, and then you got an hour for every hour back.
Okay, yeah.
And that really puts the pressure on the company to make sure they budget correctly, because what happens, and it works fine as well, because like one of the things when we did the golf club is that we did like a ton of overtime. We worked till 10, 11 o'clock every night for 3 months, but it came at a cost in the fact that all of us were out for 6 weeks after that. And we couldn't come back into work, which was great. So the company knew that, and they go, it's worth that cost. And everybody that worked on the game loved it as well, because I don't mind putting the effort in a Nova Scotian winter when it's minus 30 for me to have the whole of June and July off when it's nice and sunny enough at the beach and 30 degrees.
Yeah, nice.
So everyone else felt the same. So it's like, if things are working like that and you know the cost, it's not too bad. It's, you know, there's a lot of, I'm anti-crunch in the fact that I don't want people to think it's free work for people's passion. I think that's completely wrong.
Sacrifice again, isn't it?
Yeah. But again, going back to the Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, is that you don't make Born to Run going in for 9 to 5. You know, it's a passion that, you know, you go, okay, I want to stay late because I want to get this thing right and I want to get this right. And as a team bonding thing, it works really, really well as well. So there's a fine line. It's making sure that people want to do it, making sure people are excited to do it, and making sure that you get reimbursed for doing it, you know. And the thing is, it's got to the point in the games industry now that crunch is looked on so badly that if somebody's done 5 minutes extra, it's like, I'm not crunching. It's like, no, that's 5 minutes extra.
Can I ask, just if you're a new producer and particularly looking at your experience, do you have any top tips for how to form good relationships with your teams and particularly with discipline leads, if you maybe not have had the same background in design and code as you?
It's one is try not to be too chummy. And it's like, I don't know, it's a personable skill. It's funny, like I employed a lead programmer several years ago, say 5 or 6 years ago, and he was so desperate. It was his first chance at being a lead. And he was so desperate to have everyone on his side. Everyone just wound up by him because he was like, oh, yeah, I'm your friend. It's like,
that's creepy, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was like, yeah, very, really creepy. And I had to have a word with him going, look, just be yourself, man. Just like, but yeah, I'd say be yourself. Make sure that, you know, you're bought into the game. Be nice to people. Ask, especially discipline leads, like their views and thoughts and things. Make people feel included in the game. And once people feel included and they feel that you're helping them out, they'll be on your side. I think, you know, and that's one of my things of always, what is a producer? A producer is somebody who's like holds the umbrella to all the shit that's coming down from above and has the like a big snowplow that plows all the risks out of the way. So it's just like, see what's coming down the road, make sure that everyone can just continue working and not be bothered by pointlessness.
How much of production is what you've just described, and how much of it needs to be at least a competent grasp of project management?
It'd be interesting, because maybe people would say, I've not got any grasp of project management. I would say it's, I don't know, 50-50, 60-40 maybe. It's strange because I don't think I'm a particularly good project manager, but then a lot of the studios I've gone to have all gone, well, you know a load about project management. I think, you know, my life is made easy. I'm a programmer, so I'm a lazy man. I'm a lazy producer. I'm going to do things that is going to make my life easier so I can play the game more at all times. The best asset you can have as a producer, if you want to be really good, is to see the amount of risk coming down the road and de-risk it before it even becomes an issue that anyone's even seen it.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. I mean, I've written some stuff on risks and issues because I thought that was the most important thing to write as an opener on game-production.com, was like, you need to understand risks and issues, guys. You know, I know you're joking, you're calling yourself lazy. I would call it lean. I would say what you're actually describing is you want to reduce waste, right? You want to make sure that people are only doing what they actually have to do. If people are working until midnight, because they want to, because it's fun for them, because it's giving them something. You want to at least know that your producers have given them a bit of work which is actually going to come out and is actually a sensible thing to be working on, right? And I think that level of project management, I can totally understand that producers need. I've worked in places which have got separate project managers, which I didn't personally think worked very well. And I think from, you know, going back to what you were saying about it being it pulls people in different directions, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's the thing. And it works very well for me now at Mediatonic, actually. I've got a producer working with me, and she's more project manager based than myself. And she's like on the button. You can ask her about anything and she knows exactly what it is and what percentage it's through. And it's like, and it's great. Like, and she's she's completely bought into what I've brought in. And I think like she's amazing at the amount of stuff she's got in her head at the time, and she can run it. And then I do all the things that she doesn't want to do as much, where like I deal with the publisher and I stop all the issues so she can continue to project manage and the team can continue to work. And that, I think that's working really, really well. But it's not worked well a lot of times I've worked. This is actually the best relationship I've had with a co-producer stroke project manager.
Okay, interesting. So just going back to the golf club briefly, just finishing off a few questions there. What was the hardest part of making that game?
The hardest part from a production point of view, or from this is a really hard game? I know, actually, I do know. Cross-platform on Sony, Microsoft, getting that meeting happening, because we were the first company to do it.
Were you? I had no idea.
Yeah, and I had to really set that up, and like Microsoft were like, no, and then Sony were no, and then I think I said one of them had said yes, and then the other one said yes. I don't know, I can't remember exactly what happened, but yeah, it was coming, like how we were going to show usernames across the thing, because some people could be called the same name that weren't the same people, stuff like that. So the golf club user, if you weren't a PS4, and the same with if you weren't an Xbox Live person, it's like, so they've made another platform.
Just you've made me think now about QA, because I've worked with both Sony and Microsoft QA teams being kind of shipped in at the end to see if they can find more than 1,000 bugs in your game. Have you had that kind of experience as well of working with external QA teams?
Yeah, done quite a bit with external QA teams as well. One of my big things, especially when I'm working on a console game, is to make sure there's enough in the budget to get a top compliance QA team in. Because it's like, I know when I was at Team 6, they couldn't believe that we passed, I think, second submission, and the only reason we had to submit a second time is because there was one bug that was stopping us. And they were going, we normally have to do like 8 or 9. And I was going, just get these guys. And you think it's going to be expensive, but in what it saves you, it's cheap.
I detected a healthy respect for QA when you were saying a few things earlier. Is that correct? Because I know, you know, we all know, right, that QA don't get the love they deserve.
Yeah, well, I always say this, because I always say there's no bugs in any of my games, so I put QA on them. But but yeah, there is a vital part of the game process as anyone else, and as I said earlier, it breaks my heart that people who are really, really good at it feel they have to get out of it if they really want to. You know, there's a set few jobs that you can earn a decent living out of it, but you can't just stay in QA and be good at QA. Like, you could be good at being a programmer or good at being a designer.
Final question about the golf club, if I may. If you could have gone back and done one thing differently, what would it have been?
Could have done one thing differently on that game. It was near perfect.
Good answer.
Yeah.
Made it more perfect.
Yeah. It's like, I would have liked, like, from a production point of view, like, I think we got it just right. Like, we chose the right decisions. We wanted multiplayer, but instead of going down the route where we'd have to get a ton of QA and do all the Sony and Microsoft multiplayer stuff, we created an ability to record ghost balls. So you recorded the ghost ball and it showed it like a second later. So it still looked like it was live. No one ever knew, but you weren't live. And it was like Sony were going, no, you can't do this. And we're going, we can. And they're going, oh, you can. Yeah, Louis, no. And things like that. We were smart. I had a good, really, really good tech lead, and he was a very clever guy. And we were smart about how we went about them kind of things. Mm. We were really lean. We got so much out of the small budget that we had to be able to get like seven, eight out of tens. My biggest mistake was leaving after Golf Club 2 because I thought, it's run its course now and it seems like it's got even better.
Run its course, good one.
Yeah, boom, boom.
That's interesting, isn't it? I wonder how much is a direct result of your approach to the pods and the creativeness that you foster in teams, that you did manage to keep it lean and you managed to keep it that people were coming up with these sort of really dynamic, interesting solutions to problems, right? That maybe if they had felt they were under the cosh, they wouldn't have even bothered thinking about.
Yeah, definitely. Like, not to blow my own horn, but like the original budget and what the original idea for the game was, as I said, three clicks, golf course, you play it. Mm. And that's what the budget, and then the budget plus, I think, $500,000 extra for the extra features that we went for in the end. We got a huge golf game that beat EA's Tiger Woods series that basically buried it. So
yeah,
that was immense, and it proved justified. I felt justified in the way I managed the team, because a lot of people thought that I was wrong at the time, and then that gave me huge amounts of confidence to go and do that in other places.
Why did they think you were wrong?
Well, because I wasn't doing it by the book, you know. I got in and I cancelled all the daily stand-ups like I always do.
Gotcha.
And they're going, well, you've got to have daily stand-ups. It's like, why? Well, because the book said.
Scrum of scrums. Where's your scrum of scrums? Were you able to do that with Championship Manager? Because, of course, that, you know, the reviews for that were like, this has come up with so many great new ideas, and the way that this game has been designed and carried out, it's a challenger to the bigger one, and you know, it was seen as saving the fat franchise, wasn't it?
I think what we did with Championship Manager, and some of the good decisions that were made that weren't part of my stuff, was that we went from the very beginning and built an extremely solid base game. And that allowed us to do things that, when we got to the point where I was the lead designer, the things that I wanted, like a free kick set piece creator, training drills, things like that, they were a lot easier to do with the tech that we had. Mm. Where our competitor, Football Manager, still to this day hasn't got it, because I know that they struggle because their tech, it wasn't built in a way that allowed them to do them kinds of things. Mm. And you know, every year I smile when I see Football Manager's latest feature list, and I go, oh, there's one of mine from 2004. And, you know, and it's like, I think a good start, you know, well thought out tech plan at the beginning of that project, and then me getting there and having some ideas. You know, it was a group of us, it wasn't just me, but it was a group of really big football fanatics and football management fans that were creative and wanted to push, you know, and we did some cool stuff, you know, and I think that's what helped it. It wasn't definitely the way that production was run, because it was strangely poor. That's why I think it could have been even better. I think we most probably would have hit that goal maybe a game or two earlier if we'd done it right.
Yeah, so it was kind of like you were fighting your own battles internally as the lead designer, but not in the position to do much more, right?
Yeah, exactly. I used to go to bed with a headache. Dream I had a headache and wake up with a headache.
Right.
It was shocking.
Right. Yeah. And all you want to do is play football for Manchester United.
Yeah. I did learn a great deal from the senior producer there, though, in the last year, because he was so bad. I mean, this is an easy job. I can do it better than that guy. Yeah.
So I really am fascinated. What gave it away that it was so bad? What the producer
was. Well, he was ultra aggressive. Right. I remember interviewing people with him, and it was the most uncomfortable thing. He'd just stare at them to see if they'd ramble. He sort of semi-chased me around the office once to have a go at me, because he'd been undermined in some way, and he didn't like it. And he was sort of chasing me around the office like he was going to have a bar fight with me. It was like, mental, that guy. Everybody hated him. Like, it was just like, you're not doing what you're meant to do here. You're not making a team bond together. Was,
yeah,
I think he saw it as his chance to be king of the world. He was trying to, and that was the problem. And that's what you can't do, because that's not, you're in charge of the project. You're not the boss of everyone. Mm. I think that's what people need to understand.
And you've got to nurture them, haven't you? Because there can be a lot of burnout when you're heading towards those midnights and all that. Dying breed, probably, right?
Yeah, I don't think you can get away with it anymore. Like, I don't know what it's like at some of the old school places, but like, I know, like, Mediatonic would just never allow that. And it's one of the nicest things. After me spending the year at Imagination doing stuff with Jaguar Land Rover, it was great to get back to Mediatonic and just like go, oh, so nice. Everyone here is nice. Everyone's lovely. It's a lovely place to work.
Mm.
And you just don't get any of that sort of bullyingness. It's like no one's really bullying. It's like everyone's been given the chance to do their job and to impress. And that's what you want.
With a minimum of politics and backstabbing.
That's all you want.
Yeah. Stay in the games industry, kids. Just make sure you choose the right place. I'm going to skip a lot of the rest of the production questions and career advice, because I think you've given a lot of career advice. And there is one that I like, though, which is, what are really bad recommendations that you could give producers? Like, what have you heard producers being told that you would go, no, that just, you don't need to know that? What's really bad advice?
I think the thing that I always laugh at and point out to young people not to do, is if I see it, it's like micromanaging meeting. And it's like, you'll see it, like, I've been at studios where you'll see, you're sitting there and you see the producer, and what's happened, and I think that this is how it normally goes, is they've got like a imposter syndrome about them. They've been put in charge of something. They're worried that they don't really know what's going on. And instead of just being relaxed and calm and going, okay, I've got the people here in my leads that are trustworthy and can get the job done. Everyone here has got a skill that they can get this job done. It's like, we're going to panic. And then you grab everyone to constantly get status updates at all points until there's no status update, because nobody's done any work, because they're constantly sitting there telling you the status updates. And one of the most important things, and this is a good thing about being a programmer, is that it takes a long time to sit down and get your head in the right mindset to code. And then when you're coding, you're in a flow. And then if you stop that person from coding to get a status update, they are then lost for another hour. So you are losing chunks and chunks of days every time you do these things. And that, I think, is the big thing, is let people sit there, get on with their work, and keep their flow going.
I think that's huge. It almost kind of makes you think that producers should just be able to go to a place and get kind of like advice on the different personalities, the different departments, and how people work, like when and when not, and how not to interrupt, etc. I think that you're quite right with the coders. I think that's a huge thing. I've known producers in the past that I've had to stop who do exactly that. They're walking around desk by desk going, oh, hi, I've been asked to get an update from my senior producer. What are you up to? What you've been working on? How's it going? How many hours have you got left? Well, that's more hours than you had before. How many hours have you really got? But why has that gone up? And it just winds up coders so much, doesn't it? They just want
one of the reasons I love story points is because it takes, you don't need that how many hours you've got left. Story points are only burnt once you've completed the story. And it's like, they're burnt now. So I don't have to go around and go, did you do 8 points today? Like, that makes sense. So you do, so it gets rid of that. Again, another lean or lazy, whichever one you want to choose, way of doing things. It's like, there's nothing worse than seeing a producer going around saying, oh, update your tasks in Jira every evening.
I think we're going to brand lazy lean right now on this podcast.
Okay. Yeah, there you go.
The Anthony style of lazy lean. I like that. Just going to write that down. Done. Right, that's ours. Why would anyone want to be a producer, do you think?
Oh, it's a good question.
Let me interrupt your answer to say, the reason I'm asking you this is, if you look at people's first choice in the games industry of a job, no one says, oh, do you know what? I'm 18, 16, whatever. I'd really like to be a games producer. That sounds like a great job. I say no one, but I think I think hardly anybody thinks that way. They think, I want to design a game. I want to be doing the art for a game. I want to be doing whatever. In the same way that they don't think about going into QA, they, you know, no one goes and says, I've done a degree in QA so I can join the game industry. I think with production, it's the same thing, right? This, I mean, there are no degrees in doing whatever for production. So what's the appeal? Why would somebody sort of sacrifice other choices and become a producer? Or would you say, from your experience, don't bother, mate, go and you know, get some experience around the games industry doing other things first and then become one?
I personally enjoy it more than any other job mostly available in the games industry at the moment. I love it. Like, if I could go back to my days at Anko and program, produce, and design all at the same time, that's what I'd want. But that job doesn't exist anymore. But like, to be able to run with the game, like, and be the person that everyone goes to go, how's this game doing? Is it running well? Who are in charge of it? Make sure it's good, blah, blah. And put, like, I enjoy the pressure. I enjoy the fact that when the game comes out, you go, okay, I made that. I don't know. Why wouldn't you choose it? I think you've got the most amount of fun if you are personable and like to be dealing with people that are going to put a bit of pressure on, and you can protect your team. I think it's a bit like, why would you be a football manager? And it's like, why would you take that pressure on dealing with the media and dealing with players and dealing with all the results and the crowd? Well, you know, sometimes you make a great game like the golf club and it's like, hey, and then other times you make games like really bad and you go, oh man, that was me. But yeah, it's like you have a chance to do something and touch everything. Like, if you improve the way the game is built from a methodology standpoint and the game becomes better because of it, that's a huge, huge bonus, I think. You know, and the other thing is you see people leaving with a smile on their face because they enjoy working with you. It's always good.
Thank you. That's a lovely answer. And so what's next for you? Is it the shared MMO for your dad and you to work together?
That's a good thing. I don't know, really. Career-wise, I'm quite happy. Mediatonic, you know, I'm in a sort of lucky position that I don't need to strive for the stars. I just like making games, you know. I'm not out to be king of the world. So I just want to keep making games and having fun, really. And I get to do that. So.
Dare I ask, and I don't have to record this bit, I can get rid of it if you don't want to talk about it, but you had mentioned a book.
Well, I did. And like, the thing is, my book would be very, very lean in the fact that it's like the process that I come up, yeah, it's like, I don't even think it could be a book, because like, talking about what we have done is like, I take Agile as a base and then I cut it back, and it was always given the code name Zone Processes, where it came about on the golf club properly, but it was keeping everyone in the zone, and that was what it was all about. It was making sure that people stayed in the zone. There wasn't any meetings outside of the core working hours. Most people just stuck to it. And I used to spend most of my time in the kitchen and then get status updates and everything from people when they were getting coffee, because that's when they were already out of the zone.
Yeah.
But see, as soon as you put something in a calendar for someone and you go, you've got a meeting in half an hour, and then you finish a task and they go, okay, I've got a meeting in half an hour, there's no point starting another one. And then that meeting goes on, and then you finish that meeting and you go, well, lunch is in 45 minutes. No point in really starting anything now either. So you've lost nearly a whole morning. Where if you just stand out by the coffee machine and you grab them and you go, okay, I was thinking this and thinking that, they'll go, okay, yeah, they've had the whole meeting that they thought they were going to have in 10 minutes, sit back down, and boom, they're away. And so I was going to call it the zone process and sort of write a process around that. But I don't know if it's possible. As I said, it could be a pamphlet.
That's what's next for you. I'm quite personally gutted that there's no shared MMO on.
You never can tell. So I'm always messing around in Unity in the evening. So I've got a little, like over in Ireland, there's this little old card game called 25 that only old people really play, and it's sort of dying out. And I started building that in Unity just to see if I could learn Unity. And I thought, oh, a card game would be nice and easy. It turns out card games are harder than first-person shooters in Unity. yeah. Massively hard and a real pain, but I'm doing that, so I would really like to get that out at some point this year and go, okay, there you go. I did one thing for Irish culture and look at there. Game of 25 going. So that would be my next thing. I think it would be good if I can get that out.
Mm.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I hope to learn a lot more from your website.
Thanks for listening. As always, we really appreciate your thoughts and feedback about the show. You can reach out to us by visiting game-production.com's podcast pages and leaving comments under each episode. We have a Facebook group and YouTube channel that you can find linked from the website. If you want to contribute or fancy a chat in the future, we'd love to hear from you.